Hello and welcome to episode 40 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. I can't quite believe we've made it to number 40, but this edition finds me in conversation with Dr. Tim Bradshaw, Chief Executive of the Russell Group. We hear about Tim's very much unplanned career journey from a geology PhD to presenting to a US Senate committee and then policy work in the House of Lords and the CBI before moving to a succession of roles in the Russell Group. Tim advises that the Russell Group, which comprises 24 research-intensive universities, is concerned primarily with helping members network, share information and best practice, as well as engaging with government, mainly about improving the operating environment via intelligent regulation and sustainable funding. And with talking to the media, trying to get good stories out there, although it can be hard getting the papers interested in good news stories about higher education. We explore the challenges of persuading government to listen, and note that, although matters can often seem gloomy for the sector, universities have made good progress on increasing research funding. For Tim, this is a real success story in which the Russell Group played a part. The way in which the media focuses on certain HE stories is a challenge, but one area Tim thinks we could do better is in perhaps listening a little more to the concerns of ministers, looking at where they have genuine issues and finding ways to address these in order to avoid unwanted interference. Where there is suggested legislation, Tim proposes that there may be ways to address this earlier to reduce its impact, but also to give scope for influence and change in other areas. Tim remains optimistic about the future for the sector, observing that we need to find different economic opportunities for the country now we no longer have a manufacturing base. The nation needs the ideas and talent which emerge from the universities, he argues. Finally, we note that ministers now and in the future need to better understand and value what universities deliver for the country and really do need to take a longer-term perspective on such matters. I do hope you enjoy the 40th edition. Hello and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and this time it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Dr. Tim Bradshaw, who's Chief Executive of the Russell Group. Welcome, Tim.
Hello, thank you, Paul. Nice to be with you.
And technically, you're not, before anyone writes in to point out, not a registrar, but you're like a registrar in the sense that you are leading the administration of a prominent higher education organisation. So I've got to spread my net pretty wide, I think, but I have the regular pleasure of encountering you in meetings of Russell Group registrars, and you very much feel like one of us. So I think you qualify for the honorary registrar title as well as Chief Executive of the Russell Group. So it's an august position, but how did you end up there? What was your career journey from undergraduate to PhD to Chief Exec of the Russell Group?
Oh dear, thanks, Paul. Thank you for making me an honorary registrar. I do very much appreciate that. Asking about a career path, I don't have a career path. I'm afraid I'm not one of these people who plotted out their career trajectory over 20 years. It's all been to do with what's been interesting at the time and where I thought there might be a challenge to take forward. So if you want to go back into the dim and distant past, then I started out.
I do.
Okay. Well, it was dim and distant because I started out in geology. That was my passion, and I really really loved that. So I've got a PhD in geology and geochemistry from the Open University actually, and partly with Stanford because I was doing field work out in the US. And for my sins, got involved in, after doing that, work with a very august institution in America, UNLV, the University of Nevada in Las Vegas, which is really only known for two things. It's basketball team and hotel management. But it also has an interest in nuclear waste management. And I was doing work on hazard assessment for the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository. How on earth do I get from there to here? Well, to cut a long story short, part of that involved me giving a presentation on policy to a travelling Senate committee. And I thought, oh, this is actually quite interesting, you know, using science to inform policies and politicians and what happens in a country. And eventually I came back to the UK. I worked for the research councils for a little while and then worked for the House of Lords as one of their science advisors. covering the widest range of possible topics, from fish stock conservation and management to nuclear waste management to all sorts of things. And then eventually went from there into the CBI. So I worked with business for best part of 14 years. Again, science, innovation, technology sort of as a starting point, but eventually getting into all sorts of things like SME policy, tax policy, industrial strategy, and working with universities an awful lot. There was a group called the Intercompany Academic Relations Group at the time, which linked up all of the business, the academic leads in businesses. So these businesses which no longer exist, like ICI, would have had a really big academic research program. And so I linked in with their leads, and we sort of linked up businesses and universities together very nicely. And then from there came over to the Russell Group, again, to pick up on science and research policy. And for my sins, got promoted to be a director of policy. And then obviously I did something really bad, because they made me chief executive eventually. And that's where I still am. So I'm now, gosh, I've been doing this job as chief exec now for technically 5 years, although.
Good grief.
Yeah. So since, I don't know when that was now. When was that? 5 years ago. The pandemic has washed all timelines out of my brain. 5 years anyway.
Fantastic. Just before we go on to a bit more about the Russell Group, that industrial academic liaison group, or whatever it's called, that sounds out like an almost 1970s kind of corporatist creation, doesn't it? But it's the kind of thing that you kind of yearn for now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's harking back to the good old days of the 1970s. You're absolutely right. This was a group of individuals who were responsible for very large sums of industrial research spending that was being done with universities. And so it was Glaxo and Rolls-Royce and ICI and IBM, BT, all of the sort of the big names, who I'm afraid, I suppose, have disappeared a little bit more into their own individual niches now, rather than coming together collectively to work with universities, which I think is a shame. I think we've lost something there. And it would be great to be able to get back together that sort of group and get the universities back around the table again, thinking about what's the longer term strategy needed for the UK, and where can we do better.
And I think this, you know, this is fundamental stuff for our sector and indeed our government. And we'll maybe come back to that in a wee bit. Let's just talk a bit about the Russell Group as an organisation then, because I mean it is an organisation that lots of people, well, mainly within the sector, because people outside the sector don't really understand it, are sometimes a bit snarky about and critical of. But the history of it was about bringing together similar universities in the kind of post 92 era, wasn't it? About trying to organize in the collective interest of those universities. And it started off with, I think, universities with medical schools started it, didn't they?
That's right. It's grown since then. The last sort of expansion was in 2012, just before I joined. But the theme is common. The theme is these are world-leading, research-intensive universities based in the UK, really have a passion for doing groundbreaking research. It's really excellent quality stuff, and a passion for teaching as well. And I think people forget that it's not just about the sort of, you know, we brand ourselves, I suppose, as a research-intensive universities group, but it's about high-quality teaching too, and it's about some of the fantastic links we have with business and with innovation. And I think if you look at Russell Group universities, we spin out way more companies than other universities do. And increasingly over time, I think there's another thing that perhaps set us apart from some others. We're very much anchor institutions in our regions and cities. And whilst businesses may come and go and politics may come and go, There's one sort of stable element now, really, and that is often the university, often the largest employer in its region, and often, you know, they're like the gateway now to international exchange and knowledge and information. You know, we would have, you would have looked in the sort of Victorian era to our ports as being the sort of the way that we access the rest of the world. People flow, knowledge flow, goods and services coming into ports and building dynamic enterprise cultures around that. That's kind of been replaced by universities, and in particular Russell Group type universities, research intensive universities with links around the world. So if you really want to sort of tap into the exciting knowledge and development stuff that's going on in the UK, you really need to look at universities, because that's where it's all happening.
Oh, that's a really interesting analogy, Tim, with the Victorian ports thing. The other interesting thing, I think, is the way in which universities, it's not just Russell Group universities, but as you say, they're particularly big and significant in all sorts of ways, have talked in recent years much more about the scale and depth of their civic commitment, right? It's always been there, but actually I think it's been foregrounded much more because it has been slightly overshadowed by the international reach. But these two things do go absolutely hand in hand, as you rightly described it there. But I do think that civic responsibility and that civic agenda, that commitment to the life of their locality and their region is a fantastically important part of what Russell Group universities do, isn't it?
It is. And, it is overlooked. If you just look at the number of people, okay, let's look at the number of dimensions to this. Let's look at the number of people we employ. I mean, directly and indirectly across the Russell Group, something like 260,000 people. And many of those in very sort of high value jobs for the local area. So they are going to that just on its own. That's going to have a multiplier effect in terms of the impact on the local economy. We bring in huge numbers of students. Now, I know there can be issues around students taking over whole areas of town with student parties and things. Okay, fine, we understand that, we deal with that. But in terms of an economic value, that is also huge for local regions. That's just sort of two dimensions. Third dimension would be around, as I said, around sort of the research and innovation, spinning out companies, attracting other major players into the area to base their research facilities there or other operations, because they can tap into the skills and knowledge base at university. So you have that sort of attractor factor of universities bringing in new and exciting things. And then there's lots of other stuff that goes on behind the scenes that no one perhaps really knows about. So for example, over the last few years, local governments have cut back on funding for galleries, arts, museums and things like that. Very often it's universities that have stepped into that space to keep those cultural assets running, very much for the community. So we're talking about arts venues, museums, galleries, theatres, the whole spectrum of things. And maybe we don't do a very good job of branding those that they're now actually run, supported, owned by universities, because they'll still bear their original names. And then one thing perhaps people have noticed, perhaps more recently with the pandemic, is some of the relationships we have with hospitals. And up and down the country, our universities and others like ours have played a fantastic role in the pandemic. Getting medical students graduated faster to get them out into the workplace quicker, releasing nursing students so that they can come and help and support, and just the general support that the universities have provided through the pandemic in terms of coordinating activities on a local ground with the sort of health protection agencies and things like that. So it's a multidimensional thing in terms of civic responsibility. And I think often overlooked, and maybe because it's so multidimensional, it's like universities are almost everywhere. We're into mental health support. We're into COVID support. We're generating jobs. We're spinning out companies. We're regenerating areas in towns and cities. Actually, I was going through Bristol recently, and you can see what's they're planning to do around the Templemead station there. Cambridge has been doing things up in the new developments with housing and facilities and labs in Cambridge. And I remember when I was in Nottingham, the Raleigh factory and things like that. You'd never recognise it now. It's a fantastic redevelopment that the university has done. And often we're not given any credit for any of this, I'm afraid, which is okay.
It is. So what's the I completely agree with all that. What's the role then of the Rosser Group in supporting the articulation of that purpose and delivery of its member universe? So what, another way of saying this, what does the Rosser Group actually do to to help to add value to that message?
Yeah, just sort of one step back from that. You know, what does the Rosser Group do?
Yeah,
as a starting point is, you know, it is a small membership organisation. Yes, like-minded universities spread across the UK, so in England and the devolved nations as well. Fundamentally, a few things that we do. One is about best practice sharing and networking and bringing the universities together, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. If somebody has a really good idea and they're willing to share it, we provide facilitate that sort of knowledge and information sharing. Yeah. So that's one aspect of what we do. But I suppose one of the key things we do is talk to government a lot. We talk to government a lot in Whitehall and the devolved nations. Yeah, principally about sort of one thing, and that is making the operating environment as good as we can for our universities so that you can get on with the job that you're best at doing. And so and across many different areas, but two broad things would be around intelligent regulation and legislation and around sustainable funding. Because I think if you've got the regulation and legislative base right, and you've got funding rights, then that solves quite a lot of the problems and universities can get on and do what you're best at doing. That's really what I want to try and achieve with what we do. The other angle, though, is often talking to the media and explaining what's going on, trying to get good, positive news stories out there in terms of the value and impact that our universities are having. Can be a challenge sometimes. I have to say that, you know, it's much easier for newspapers digitally or in print to sell things which are all about bad news and the latest scandal or whatever. And then we end up in sort of trying to tell them this isn't a problem or bat back things. But we do try very hard to get some of those positive messages out there as well. Through case studies, through blogs and narratives and things that we could feed into journalists and publish ourselves. So it's a networking and helping members. It's trying to get the environment right with government, and it's trying to set the message straight or get good news stories out there with the media. Those are sort of three broad things.
Yeah. That's really helpful, Tim. On that middle one, then the kind of getting the environment right, and that's where you most closely engage with politicians and policy makers, right? How willing are they to listen, right? I mean, you know, because there is a sense in which, you know, any party comes in with a manifesto, right? It's got some ideas about what it wants to do, and it's going to pursue those ideas. And what you or the Rosser Group or Rosser Group members think is not necessarily going to be top of their list. So how do you engage with them and seek to persuade them?
We have to use all the tools that are available to us, really. Every government comes in with its own ideas about what it wants to do. So it starts off trying to engage with people before they become in government. So when they're writing their manifestos or thinking about the sort of things that they should prioritise. There are so many different ways of trying to influence. But what we try and do is make sure that we've got the background evidence that will help underpin any messages that we want to give to government as a key thing, so that they can't undermine our message by having their own alternative data. We try and get the best sort of data and information and examples that we can to demonstrate the points that we're trying to make. Now, how do you influence? It's difficult. Often there are many people who are involved. So you might, or many parts of government that are involved. So it might be the Treasury and BEIs and ministers and SPADs and officials. And you have to try and work out who it is who's the most important person within a sort of a wide range of potential sort of targets that you're trying to influence. So it can, almost every problem looks like it's sort of multidimensional, but often there's one individual or there's one small group of civil servants or a special advisor who you need to try and convince. And it's identifying them first and then making sure that you've got something that speaks in their language. So we always try and think about what's their problem, what is it that they're trying to solve, and can we provide them with a solution, which in turn also helps us. And sometimes we have to be very patient in terms of how long it takes to actually get some of these things to happen. And Paul, you'll know from my visits to the registrar's group that I'm often there as Mr. Doom and Gloom because everything seems terribly. So just for your listeners, whilst we all sort of wrangle with the doom and gloom of post-Brexit fallouts and culture wars and things like that, I would just like to sort of highlight one thing that you really ought to focus on, and that is what we were successful with in terms of research funding. And this isn't just a Russell Group. I can't claim this is a Russell Group only win. We worked with many other partners on this, and others were sort of all pushing in the same direction. But it shows what you can do when you do work together. And this is the government's commitment to massively increase research funding by the end of the parliament. So I think a few years ago, the last previous spending review to the one we just had, I think we ended up with about £12 billion a year on government commitment for research and development spending. And the latest spending review moves that commitment up to £20 billion a year by 2024-25. Which in anybody's terms is a fantastic achievement. There's a huge amount of additional investment coming. And it's up to universities then to sort of work out how best to tap into that. And it may not come through the sort of routes that everyone would normally expect, like UKRI. You may have to go and talk to Department for Transport or the MOD or the Foreign Commonwealth Office or whoever else now has research budgets again in the way they probably would have had 10 years ago. But this was a major success for the Russell Group, for other organisations who are all working together to demonstrate to government the value of research and innovation, what this would do for the economy, what this can do for jobs, what this can do for society. So yes, we have successes, and they're meaningful. But yes, it can also be very difficult, and there are quite often ideological problems that we have to try and find workarounds for. With government, and so it's not all rosy on the policy advocacy side.
No, and I'm sure that many would agree with that.
You're going to talk to me about culture stuff now, aren't you?
I wasn't. I mean, I think that yes, that is great success to hear, and it is really important, and will have long lasting impact as well. And I think that it is important to get a sense of perspective, right? Because, whilst it's very easy for, for ministers and backbenchers or whatever to go on about, free speech issues and, trigger warnings and Jane Austen and who's been banned and all the rest of the fluff and nonsense. And it's great tabloid fodder, right? It's important not to lose sight of bigger issues, right? And to go back to the point about the contribution universities make to their local regions, their economies, but also the culture and the general environment, particularly at a time of great national economic and social stress. I think that is really important. We shouldn't lose sight of that. We shouldn't lose sight of the research contributions we make, and we shouldn't lose sight of those medical health wider benefits we all contribute to as well. So I think that's all really important, and it is important not therefore to be unduly fazed by the fluff and the stuff that the tabloids come out with, which often of course do focus on Russell Group members, because they're often two Russell Group members in particular, Oxford and Cambridge, just because they are seen as the universities that everyone will have heard of, right? And so it makes it easier to build a story around them. We shouldn't lose perspective, but it's quite difficult not to sometimes, just because they seem so prominent. So the question I was going to ask you then, Tim, is how do we just have to live with it and hope that everyone will move on eventually, right? And there'll be another, there'll be some other part of society that will become the fixation for tabloids, etc. Or do we need to develop some response to it as a collective, but either Russell Group or more broadly in the sector, that actually seeks to kind of reframe the the position of higher education as part of society, because it does seem to me that, you know, we contribute massively to our nation in all sorts of ways. Most of that isn't recognised. We do our best, but it's so important, as the recent Tony Blair Institute reports it, for future national productivity, that universities continue to educate students who will become graduates, who will be incredibly productive and valuable members of society and help the economy continue to grow, as well as doing many, many other beneficial things, both for them personally and their families and society more broadly. We have to get that narrative raised, don't we?
We do. And I think there is one thing that we can do rather better, and that is that often ministers have a particular issue that they are concerned about. And they will worry it to death because they really want to make a change. And, you know, and fair dues, that's what they're in politics for. They want to try and make a change around some specific things that they're interested in, or their communities are interested in. Now some of those things are very important. Don't get me wrong, really, really very important. But in the grand scheme of things, less so. But they're the things that actually get attention. It's always like the sort of the 1% or the 5% of stuff that ends up in the newspapers that gets everyone's attention, and that's why everything else gets sort of overlooked. So sometimes we probably don't do as well as we should do as a group, and that does not just the Russell Group, but universities in general, in terms of listening to some of those challenges that are put to us by ministers and special advisors, and thinking, actually, they probably got a point here. How can we respond to that and do that positively without shouting about it too much, and just tick that off and move on to whatever the next thing is, so that it doesn't just drag on and drag us down? And so, you know, there are some, you know, let's be fair, there are probably some genuine concerns in the free speech area, not so much about free speech, but around the perceived monoculture sometimes in universities. And, you know, are there ways that we can work a little bit harder to address that? Yes, I think there probably are. And if we did that and we engaged ministers when we were doing this, I think that would make life an awful lot easier for us. And there are probably one or two other key things that current ministers are interested in and would like to see us do, which probably don't cost us very much. But if we actually showed that we were being honest and genuinely open and addressing them, would probably give us a little bit more breathing space to be able to challenge on some other areas where we think, you know, the latest legislation is a bit mad or disproportionate and could be done in a different way.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very good point. So you mentioned earlier when you're often the person who's bringing the gloomy messages to meetings of registrars or whoever. But what's your view on the future for our sector then? I mean, are you fundamentally, you know, pessimistic or more optimistic? And, you know, and why?
Oh gosh, no, I'm fundamentally absolutely Mr. Optimism, honestly. I genuinely think that, you know, all right, let's just park that. I'll come to why, but I need to go back a little bit. Right, if I come at this from a sort of an economic angle, so apologies for everyone out there who would like me to come to this from a very sort of more social angle, but, you know, I like the economic side of things, and this probably goes back to me working in the CBI, where I had two successive members of the Monetary Policy Committee as my direct bosses. So I have a sort of, they instilled economics into me, sorry. Right, so let's go back to the beginning here. What does the UK do in terms of generating its economic wealth? Well, you can't do it through fishing. There really isn't very much we can do in terms of adding to life and the economy through fishing. There's a little bit, but not very much. We don't, as a geologist, I'm very sad about this, but we can't dig up very much anymore in the UK. I was down in Cornwall on holiday recently, but maybe they can go and mine the old China clay heaps for lithium, and we can have a massive battery technology system for the future. That'd be great. But park that. We can't really mine very much in the UK. So we're not going to hunt our wealth. We're not going to dig up our wealth. For good or ill, we have outsourced our manufacturing capabilities to the likes of Germany, South Korea, China, et al. And we may get some of that back. And we do have some really good advanced manufacturing stuff. Let's not forget that. But the bulk manufacturing of sort of everyday products, we don't really do in anywhere like the extent that we have done in the past or perhaps should do. So you're chipping away at all these various things that the economy could be underpinned by. And actually what you're left with is sort of the service sectors and things which are driven by ideas and talent. And the ideas and talent, where do they come from? Well, actually, the talent pretty much comes through universities and comes through our universities. So that is a huge pipeline of skills, abilities, talent for the future. You look at, we train something like 80% of the medics and dentists, 50% of the scientists and engineers that come through and graduate in the UK come through our universities, and more in some other disciplines. And so that's the sort of the talent side, and the ideas side out of the research base, the fundamental, really sort of clever stuff that discovery research our universities do, which in turn leads on to more applied research and in turn leads on to innovations that we then take for granted in everyday life, be they in a medical setting or work setting or wherever it happens to be. So if you have that premise in terms of what's going to underpin the UK economy, and I do think it is ideas and talent, then universities are absolutely front and centre of that. And I would really, really, really like our current ministers and our future ministers to better understand and value what universities are going to bring the UK. Because often they're focused on a much shorter timescale. What's happening now? You know, will people get graduate jobs next year or whatever? What's the research turned into a $1 billion company now? Yeah, that's fine. They have to do that. That's their job. But they also need to take that longer term perspective, because you have to look at it in terms of, if you took out universities, for example, and pretend there were no Russell Group or other research intensive universities in the UK, what would our future look like in 10, 20 or 30 years time? I think we'd look like a third world nation very, very quickly, because if you haven't got the ideas and talent to underpin society, underpin the economy, then you are nowhere. Because I said, you can't fish, you can't hunt your economic web, you can't dig it up. We've outsourced most of the bulk manufacturing. So you haven't got any of the clever stuff either, then you really are in a big problem. And I think that's where I'd say universities are fundamentally front and centre for the future of the UK.
That's absolutely great, and I completely agree with all of that. But I think it's a really interesting way of looking at it, and I hope people listen to that point of view. One final thought, right? When I spoke recently to Alistair Jarvis, who's standing down as chief executive of Universities UK, and one of the questions I asked him was, how do you get consensus, in a room full of vice chancellors, right? Well, you've got a smaller room full of vice chancellors, right? But you've got 24, very strong-minded individuals in the room. How do you help get them all onto the same page? And have they ever all agreed on something?
Well, look, first of all, can I just say congratulations to Vivian Stern, because she's just been announced today as Alistair's replacement.
Indeed.
So well done to Vivian, and thank you to Alistair for the sterling job he's done with the UK over the years. And the Russell Group in the UK do work very close together on certain things. Yeah, Alistair has a difficult job, so Vivian will have a difficult job too, trying to marshal so many universities and trying to get a consensus view. But it's difficult with just 24 as well, to be honest. But we try, and very much so in certain areas, there are things which we all agree on, particularly the things where we have a sort of a strong focus, like research or innovation or some of the international dimensions of things that we do. It's not been as difficult as perhaps I thought it might have been. There's a willingness to compromise around the edges and to make sure that we end up with ultimately a sort of policy direction which everyone can agree with. Now, not everyone's going to agree with absolutely everything we say. We understand that. But over the sort of a period of a policy cycle or across a range of issues, then yes, we do manage to bring everyone together. But it does become more difficult the more diverse your membership, I imagine.
Tim, thanks ever so much for the conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And thank you for being very broad ranging in your answers. I do appreciate it.
That's OK. Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.